the Surfside condo collapse and its impact for years to come. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It's been more than a month. The rubble has been cleared and the final victim has been identified. What will healing mean for the survivors and residents of the community of Surfside? Also, imagine sharing a name with a person wanted for murder and spending years behind bars for their crime.
I had the show. I said, that's the dude I'm in prison for.
The story of Thomas James from Miami and what it tells us about criminal justice. And finally,
the voters, including more than one-third of the voters being African Americans, voted for a city of Miami.
Today is Miami's 125th birthday. We'll learn about some of the city's most interesting history that seldom gets mentioned. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the final victim of the Surfside condo collapse has been identified. The debris has been cleared. What was once a 13-story condominium tower is now an empty plot of land. An investigation continues, lawsuits are piling up, and now the debate heats up as to what should go in that space. But for now, let's look at something else. We're joined by WLRN's Veronica Zaragovia, who was at a press conference this morning at a warehouse in Doral, speaking with survivors. Veronica, what was the purpose of the gathering today and why Doral?
Well, we're in Doral because of the location of the warehouse of the Global Empowerment Mission, GEM, and they do a lot of response after crises. And right now they're helping the survivors of the Champlain building collapse. And so they had like a town hall here so that the survivors who knew about this event could come and ask questions about how they can get help and get some information about support that's available to them.
Tell us about how people are feeling now that the debris is cleared and the site is cleared and everyone found has been identified.
You know, today's event was actually, I feel pretty sad about having spoken to people who are not doing that well. There was one survivor, his name's Gabriel Neer, he's 25, and he told me he's really struggling with mental health, and he feels a lot of survivor's guilt, he feels trauma. He's staying with his 7-member family in two rooms at a hotel in Surfside, and he feels like it's just constant, like every day continues to be about this tragedy, and he had his hope set on going to medical school, and he just mentally can't do that anymore, and he's just could really use some help in terms of work. And then there was another woman, Julieta Applebaum, who started crying when I spoke to her because she feels like for some people this was their retirement home and they now don't have a place to live. They're living there, you know, fortunately they have family to live with, but it's just been really difficult. So I would say that even at this point it wasn't like the mood was much lighter.
Are there still people missing, by the way?
That they know of, they've now all the 98 missing people who had not been accounted for, let's say that they were, you know, all 98 have been identified of the people who've been deceased, and that they know of, people aren't missing, but they do continue to do a secondary search through the rubble to make sure that they haven't missed any human remains.
Yeah, and by the way, that debris and rubble, where was it taken?
They won't tell us, I assume for security purposes, but all I know from the Miami-Dade Police Department, they told me it's off-site. So what they're looking through at this point, both the Miami-Dade Police Department, since the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue has already finished its work, so the police department and the rabbis who are assisting are looking at a off-site location, and Mayor Levin Cava had mentioned that some of it is outdoors, so seems like it requires a large space, of course, for so much material.
Yeah. Now, Freddie Ramirez, the director of Miami-Dade's Police Department, explained the process of going through the rubble.
For the religious items that we're finding, currently we're now cataloging and impounding all the belongings, those from the where the collapse actually happened, and then the secondary one, which was the surviving building that was later taken down.
So, Veronica, what are Surfside leaders saying about what the tragedy has meant to the city?
The city, I guess they feel like on the one hand that the city is now synonymous with tragedy. Some of them are hoping to be leaders in what would be like, for instance, I've interviewed Commissioner Eliana Salzhauer, who had said that she feels that for Surfside, it's one of the issues she wants to bring up at their next hearing, is that they would agree that they would do a 30-year recertification process or a 30-year assessment, rather than 40 years. And the idea is that what works for Miami-Dade County as a whole doesn't work for all of the communities within it. And she is also pushing to do testing of the ground to make sure that if anything goes back on that property, even though she is against any rebuilding, that they know that it the land could support it. I had spoken earlier this week with Rabbi Yossi Harlig, who's a chaplain with the Miami-Dade Police Department, and he was also telling me that one of the things that he would recommend is that people not always be looked at with pity, the survivors, that in the long term it might help them not to always be kind of approached in a way that brings out pity, because it just makes them feel like there's some kind of stigma with what they've gone through. So there's just a lot that continues to come up with Surfside and the people who've survived this and how to move forward.
Yeah, and one of the questions too is, I know people will say it's too early too, but there are people talking about what should go there. And some people want to rebuild and other people want a memorial. But what have you heard from any of the survivors about that particular debate?
Yeah, absolutely. I asked here at this event today, as well as at the outside of the, well, during the court hearing, we heard people and outside, and there some of them are feel like they didn't have a mortgage left. You know, they had paid off their apartment. They would actually be open to living there. I spoke today with one survivor, Zulia Taub, who said that she would not like to live on that property again because of the memories that she has of all of the victims who didn't survive, but she would like to stay in the area because she was very active as a volunteer with the symphony. And she kind of, some people just feel like they would love to stay in this area, but they're priced out. That's one thing that Gabriel Neer told me that his family would like to stay, because they would like to be within walking distance of the synagogue, but it's become so expensive compared to when they had moved to the Champlain Tower South originally. And so I think people are kind of working through their emotions and what they're able to do. But of course, they're all very grateful to have a place to live, wherever that will be.
Mm. Veronica Zaragovia reporting from Doral, speaking with some of the survivors of the Champlain Tower collapse. Veronica, thank you so much for all your reporting on this. It's really powerful.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, you can follow her reporting of these stories on our website at WLRN.org. Hopefully all of those folks can recover and move forward with their lives. You know, the Surfside tragedy, I mean, has touched so many lives in South Florida. While Miami-Dade is a massive county, there are so many tight-knit communities woven throughout the region. Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Bernstein has been visiting her family's home in Surfside for years. Her parents' house is within walking distance from the collapse site. Now, by the way, you can read her personal essay about covering the tragedy. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us. You know, we just passed 1 month since the collapse, and the search and rescue team, again, identifying the final victim of the tragedy. What's going through your mind, reflecting on the tragedy that has also you've been covering for the Wall Street Journal?
You know, it is such a sad anniversary, and thank you for having me here to talk about it and reflect and be with others who are affected and talk about it. It's a very sad, I guess what's on my mind is watching Surfside sort of pick itself up from its knees, really, and move on and try to process what's happened, everybody, and mourn, and then move on. How will we go forward as a community? That's what's on my mind.
Yeah. The history behind the city of Surfside is deeply connected to the Jewish refugee community during World War II. Is that why your grandmother moved there?
Yes, my grandparents are Jewish. We're Jewish. My family is. They were not refugees. They've been here for. They were immigrants themselves, but they came as children. But they retired to. They were the type of retirees in the 40s and 50s who wanted to retire in the sun. But they came to Surfside because they could not buy as Jews elsewhere in neighboring communities, Bal Harbour and pieces of Miami Beach. So Surfside was welcoming to people very early on. It's how it was sort of created.
You know, I was talking about how, I mean, anybody who's lived in South Florida for a while, you know, from up above, it all may look the same, but honestly, you have so many different communities and you can cross the street and you're in a very different community. How would you describe, you know, Surfside compared to other cities in Miami-Dade for anybody who doesn't know it?
I think of Surfside as a small town. I feel like it, except for the ocean and how bucolic and beautiful that is, you could just take Surfside up and plop it down anywhere. It's a small town. It has this strong Jewish community. It always did. My grandparents were somewhat religious, but they were not Orthodox. Now it's got a very strong Orthodox community, but it's got a very strong Latin community. It's a mixed group there, but it's so bucolic. I always go back to this detail that Surfside does not have sidewalks. Most of Surfside does not have sidewalks. People walk in the street. You know, they drive slow. Kids play ball in the street. You see people pushing their babies and strollers. It is so low key compared to, you know, bling bling Miami, South Beach, these kinds of things. And that sticks in my mind when I think of Surfside.
You know, also it's an important place for you in different times of your life. And I'm wondering why was it an important place for mourning, especially during those difficult parts for your family?
I guess again, it goes back maybe to the bucolic, you know, way it is. The ocean is so healing. It's in the sun, but also it's small. You can walk Surfside. The businesses there, the restaurants, you go in and they know you if you're a local. It just is a community, tight knit. And when my great grandfather built this house in the late 40s, early 50s, you know, my parents ended up buying the house around 1999. But we had so many years going there from pretty much, you know, when I was born on. But when my parents bought it, we started to have every holiday there. But we also did start to heal. My mom had cancer, and it's where, you know, we took care of her and she healed. It's where we brought my dad years later after his stroke, and he's there, you know, living and powering through that. It's where I came after September 11th. I was in New York, lived there, came down here, and cannot get over how peaceful Surfside was at that time when New York was on its knees and in chaos. And so over and over for me personally and my family, we also celebrated. My sisters had their weddings there. So it was just this place of family. And I think not just for me, this is I write my column at the Journal is about relationships. And I think that's what Surfside is to everybody. It's family. And that's why this hit, it just hit families. It's why it's the biggest tragedy.
So when you got the call to cover the Champlain Tower collapse on June 24th, how did you get ready for that mentally?
You know, I didn't have much time because I woke up and didn't realize it had happened. And then my mom called and said, "Hey, I said, oh my gosh, it's this building. It's this building that I went by my whole life." And she said, "Yes." And we were talking about that and stunned. And then my editor called and said, "You know, can you go?" And so I didn't have a lot of time. And I didn't. I really internally had to dig deep because I knew I was going to be looking at something horrible and something horrible very close to home. You're going to see families destroyed right next to where your family is. It's a sad, sad thing. But I, you know, on the way, talked to my editor there and tried to just get there. As I was going in, you know, I parked. I knew how to sort of come in the back way that morning. I knew what they would have cordoned off. My parents live on this street, so as I was coming in, I parked a few blocks away and started to walk towards the rescue vehicles and where I knew this building was. And I came up on a police chief who was barricading Collins there, about a block away, two blocks maybe. And I started to identify myself and say, "I'm a reporter. I just want to, you know, see if I can get my eyes on this building and help explain what happened to our readers." And I looked in his eyes as I was talking. We both met eyes, and the look of complete sadness and shock on his face stopped me because it's how I felt already. And I just blurted out. I said, "I'm so sorry." He was is from the town over. I said, I'm so sorry. It's home. It's home to me too. And, you know, he directed me, but it was such a moment that will stick in my mind to see this, you know, police chief who's there doing his job, but again, who felt it so deeply.
Yeah. There was another moment too, in your piece, you described that was really powerful. The moment you were in your parents' home, when the rest of the Champlain South Tower had to be demolished, and what you heard and what you felt. Take me back to that moment.
So this would have been the Sunday night. So the building, you know, had gone down. This is the Sunday night of 4th of July weekend. It's 4th of July. And I had, you know, we South Florida, we were having a hurricane watch or hurricane. We're worried. We're watching a hurricane. I don't think we had a watch, but we're worried a hurricane's coming. So I decided, you know, I'll be with my folks, try to help them. You know, my dad's not that well. So we're hanging out, my mom and I, and we are my father's gone to bed, but we're hanging out. We knew that afternoon that we started to get rumors. They're going to implode this building. They're going to bring it down carefully, but they're going to take it down. And now it's the 4th and it's a weird holiday. And there's fireworks going off across the bay in people's backyards, you know, just sort of, you know, people still having their celebrations. And so we sort of sat on the bay and watched that a little bit. And then we didn't really know what to do. We knew that it was going to come down between 10 and 3. It's 3 a.m. So we decided to watch a movie and we picked some romantic comedy just really not to know what to do with yourself. It's a very strange feeling. This has already happened. Nobody's going to get hurt, hopefully, in this collapse, but it's the demolishing of more homes and it's this final sense of all of this going down. So it's terrible. It really is emotional, hard to even talk about now, but we are there watching our silly movie, which we hoped would distract us. And then about 10:30, you know, we were complaining about the movie. It wasn't that great, but at 10:30, we just heard an enormous explosion and it rocked their house. There was no way it was anything else. And my mom said, you know, is that, you know, just stunned. And I ran outside just to, I don't know, see, but also to feel it. And then there was smoke coming through down the street from the building, because they're on the same street. And it just was this moment. This moment of finality, really. This is more homes going down. This is so many lives.
It's the end of that. That's what it finally comes to, a finality. Let me finish with this. Surfside, unfortunately, is going to be synonymous with this tragedy for a while. You talked about, you know, New York after 9/11. What do you say to our listeners about, you know, how long it might take for that healing and that, for this whole thing to finally pass?
I would say, as brief as I can, I would say that it takes time, but it happens and it does start immediately. That community is still there. I learned this in New York. It's still there. You pick yourself up and you come out stronger for sure. And that's what I would say.
Elizabeth Bernstein, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Beautiful essay.
Thank you.
Again, Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. You can check out her essay. Just go to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come.
I had the show. I said, that's the dude I'm in prison for.
A case of mistaken identity leads to a life sentence in prison. The story of Thomas James next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thomas James is currently serving a life sentence in the Okeechobee Correctional Institution. James was charged with murder in the first degree after a man was killed in Coconut Grove in the 1990s during a botched armed robbery. Except Thomas James lived in Brownsville, and he'd only been to Coconut Grove once or twice in his life. Did police arrest the wrong man? Well, here's James in a phone call from prison yesterday.
My name is Thomas Renard James, and I am better known as Jake, and I have been incarcerated for over 30 years for a crime that I did not commit. I was given a life sentence for a murder that took place on January 17, 1990, in the Coconut Grove Card Gamer section of Miami-Dade County. It is my hope, wish, and prayer that my cries of innocence won't continue to fall on cold hearts and deaf ears.
Tristram Corden, a magazine writer and the director of journalism for the Florida Center for Government Accountability, tells this story in this month's GQ magazine. It's called The Tragic Case of the Wrong Thomas James. Tristram is joining us now. Great to have you back. You know, first of all, how did you first come to meet Thomas James? How did you find this guy?
Well, it took me a while to meet him. First of all, thank you very much for having me on to talk about this case. I heard about Thomas James' case when I took an old source of mine, a friend who's a felon, out for lunch. And we were talking about the state's efforts to restore voting rights to felons. And at the end of the lunch, I said to him, "Hey, Sammy, if you know anybody who you think is, has a credible case of being wrongfully convicted, let me know." And Sammy said, "Shoot, I know a guy." And at that point, he was in South Bay. "I know a guy in South Bay who's been saying he's innocent since the day I met him." And that led to this day.
And Thomas is doing life in prison during the past 30 years. He's been trying to prove his innocence at numerous opportunities. He reached out to the media to get help, but nobody responded. He even had reached out to you at one point, right? What happened then?
Yes, that was devastating to hear. I was interviewing him, and he told me, and I asked him about reaching out to the media, and he said, "You know, I reached out to you when you were at New Times, and I kind of held it together for the rest of our conversation, but afterwards I was shopping in Publix, and I just had to, and I was in my head, and I had to turn down an aisle, and I just... it hit hard. I'll say that.
Yeah.
But what happened was I had left New Times. I went back. I researched. I went to Sammy because Sammy was the one who told him to write to me. And I went to Sammy and I asked, tell me about this. And Sammy said that he reached out to me in about 2005, and I had left New Times at that time. And that's still no excuse. And it's just a lost opportunity, 20 some years. But so journalists are busy. I understand. We all understand that. But my takeaway from that is that we all need to open our eyes to the fact that if somebody is taking the effort to write from prison, we should really give them at least the cursory attention they deserve.
Yeah. Let's go to James's story. And, before we talk about him being convicted of this murder that he says he did not do, he was arrested. And this is how he ends up in court. Yeah. And then there's this mistaken identity. But what was he arrested for in the first place?
So James was a sort of a small time pot dealer in and around Brownsville. And he was picked up for a probation violation on a illegal weapons charge. The weapons charge was a significant escalation. Before that, he had just had trespass, marijuana possession, one battery on a law enforcement officer, which was when he was running during a raid and ran into a plainclothes cop accidentally, and they fell to the ground. But he was in jail awaiting resolution on this gun charge. He was in jail for about 3 weeks. He was brought in for his first hearing, and the clerk says, "Your Honor, we have a warrant out for his arrest for murder, a robbery near Coconut Grove." James is thinking, this has to be a mistake. They got my docket mixed up with somebody else. But it's not. He's charged with this murder. So things happen both fast and slow. After that, he meets his lawyer, a public defender, about three times over 6 months for about less than an hour each time. Then it's time for his trial 6 months after his arrest on the gun charge. The trial lasts 2 days and boils down to two eyewitnesses, one of whom has a brain damage, a head injury so bad he can't speak properly, and who contradicts himself on the stand. And then the other is the victim's stepdaughter, who clearly identifies James.
Yeah,
on that, he's sentenced to life in prison. The jury convicts him 2.5 days later, and he's sentenced to life in prison.
And I want to go back to the murder. So, there was one night two men reportedly entered a home in Coconut Grove. That home was owned by Francis McKinnon. That's the person who was shot and killed. And as you said, there were two eyewitnesses. that saw this man, and one person knew him as Thomas James, the other Thomas James.
Right. What correct. Did, what, she had never met him. She just knew the name Thomas James.
So
she had never seen him before.
What were people telling police at the time about Thomas James?
Absolutely. The murder happened around 7 p.m. These two men, one wearing a mask, the other barefaced, walk into this apartment to rob this elderly couple who are living on disability just outside Coconut Grove. And the man of the house, Francis McKinnon, comes out of the bedroom with a gun in his hand, and one of the robbers shoots him. One shot hits him in the face and kills him. They flee. The police arrive and canvass the area, and residents are telling the police, a dude named Dog and Tommy James did it. And you see that throughout the police notes, and you hear it on the tapes to the Coral Gables Police Department, the tip line. The lead detective then simply goes back to what was then Metro Dade Police Headquarters that night, goes into the computer system and pulls out a picture of a Thomas James and makes a photo lineup with him and several other foils, as they call them, and shows them around to eight witnesses who all said they saw Tommy James or heard it. In effect, they said they heard it was Tommy James, and nobody identifies him except for the stepdaughter and this brain damaged guy.
And you know, I'm wondering, I mean, Tristram, from your research on this story, do you think the police did as thorough an investigation as they could?
No, unfortunately, this is the laziest policing I've ever seen in over 25 years of criminal justice reporting. I mean, there were so many opportunities to check up on this, but one of the major things was everybody said it was Tommy James. They clearly knew who the Tommy James they were referring to. And the stepdaughter and the and her mother, the victim's wife, even said, we are related to Tommy James. People are telling us it's Tommy James, and it turns out we're related to him. We know his mother, Mary. That's in the police notes. It's in depositions. And Thomas Raynard James, his mother's name is Doris. He's not related to them. He's from a different part of the county. And I mean, the tragedy just compounds from there.
And have police responded to your reporting on this about how that investigation went down?
The police have not responded. The state attorney's office has responded.
Again, I'm talking with journalist Tristram Corden. His latest piece, The Tragic Case of the Wrong Thomas James, is in this month's GQ magazine. You can find a link to the story, by the way, on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And as we've been mentioning, Thomas James is doing life in prison. He's been in there for 30 years. He's investigated his own case. He's tried to figure out what really happened and tried to find that other Thomas James. Now, Tristram, right. you had a sit-down conversation with James where he explains how he uncovered the other one. Here's what he told you.
Now, I'm familiar with there's somebody with his name. So what I did, I went to my classification and asked her to look into it.
Classification is what? In prison?
Yeah.
Okay.
And she pulled the guy up, and when she pulled him up, she said, there's another Thomas James. And I just asked, I said, can you look and see what his mother's name is? And she said, Mary. And I had it wrote on a piece of paper in the palm of my hand, and I had to show her. I said, that's the dude I'm in prison for.
All right, so he finds out this other Thomas James' mother is Mary, which again, as you said, one of the eyewitnesses says, I know them, and their mother's name is Mary. But I mean, Tristram, how in the world did Thomas James come to the realization there was another Thomas James, and that's probably the guy who did the killing, and he finds this out from inside prison?
Right. He's convicted, not knowing how all of this came to be. He's walking on the yard of the first prison he's sent to, the first year of his sentence, and a man comes up to him and says, you the guy in for the murder in the Grove? And he says, yeah, but I didn't do it. And the guy says, I know. You and the guy who did it have the same name. And that's when he realized he might, there might be a case of mistaken identity. It wasn't, that was in 91. It wasn't until 96 that he got all his records, and why it took so long for him to get his records, I do not know, but it got all his records. And then he could see in all the depositions and all the police notes that, that the witnesses were clearly referring to another Thomas James.
Have you spoken to the police officer who did the initial investigation or the defense attorney from back then?
Yes, I reached out to the defense attorney who can't speak on the record because of client confidentiality. And, you know, so we did not get into a long conversation. I imagine he feels horrible. The police officer I reached out to through an intermediary and declined to talk to me. Now, yeah, I mean, if it's not too soon.
Yeah.
Can I talk about the other Thomas James?
Well, no. Well, that's the other thing I was about to ask you is you did talk to the other Thomas James. What did he say?
Right. So I reached out. So after, you know, going through all the documents, when I was ready, almost ready with this story, I reached out to the other Thomas James, who responded and said, yes, I know about the McKinnon murder. Please come talk to me. And I went and I talked to him. And the first thing he said to me was, no doubt about it, 100%, they were looking for me. They knew I ran with Dog. And in fact, Dog and I had cased that apartment. We were planning to rob it. Dog ran a robbery crew. They would steal from outlaws. But I wasn't there. In fact, I was arrested the night before. And I, Tristram Corton, went back and got the jail card for that time. And yes, in fact, he was. He was arrested for robbing some prostitutes the night before.
Why, Tristram, why did you want to talk to this Thomas James? And are you surprised that he was open with you?
I wanted to talk to him to, you know, find out if he would, you know, if we could clarify this. And I think he talked to me because he feels bad. He knows that this guy shouldn't be in prison. And, you know, finally somebody reached out to him to ask him about it.
And again, as you pointed out, you know, he said that, yes, I was the guy they were looking for because he was with Dog. And that was the other person identified in that house that night.
Yeah. Yes.
Go ahead.
The Dog, this is another amazing injustice in this story, is that Dog, Vincent Cephas Williams, he's clearly identified by witnesses at the scene. And the same witnesses pick him out of a photo lineup. So he's clearly identified. And police never track him down. They never find him, which is amazing because a couple of years later, he's in a Miami-Dade courtroom on an assault charge. And he spent some time in prison on that. And nobody thought to link the two. It's very strange and it's infuriating.
Going through the story and everything that you've learned about Thomas James and the proof he found, are you convinced of his proof?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've gone through it every which way in my head. And I don't see how he could have done it with, you know, it would have to go back to the witnesses being in on it and saying Tommy James. But even then, they're referring to the Tommy James they know. In addition, there was a witness in the apartment, a little girl, 8 years old, or 9 years old, who never gave a statement to police, even though they talked to her. And went later, when she was in her 20s, she saw a flyer saying, "Help, you know, Tommy James, he's innocent." And she said, "That's not the guy I saw commit the murder." And she remembers it clearly. And I contacted her. She's, you know, having her own problems with the criminal justice system. So I spoke to her lawyer, and her lawyer asked her for me, and she said, "Yes, absolutely, I will testify. I remember it clear as day. That's not the guy I saw shoot Mr. McKinnon."
And briefly, what happens now? Is there a chance for appeal?
So the state attorney's office has the Justice Project is looking in. It's like their conviction integrity unit. And they told me they are formally looking into this case. They've reached out to Thomas James for more information, and they are investigating it. And that's where it stands right now. He has a lawyer. Her name is Natalie Figures, who is handling the legal aspects of this. And hopefully, I say it unequivocally, I hopefully They will reach the same conclusion I reached after reviewing thousands of pages of documents. It's all there in black and white right in front of us.
This is an incredible story. Tristram Corden, again, latest piece for GQ called The Tragic Case of the Wrong Thomas James. Find it on our social media. Tristram, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
Thank you for having me on to talk about this case, Lewis.
Definitely. Again, find it on our social media, WLRN Sundial. All right, I got to take a breath after that. That is unbelievable, incredible story. Now, let's change the mood because we're going to finish up today's program celebrating because Miami turns 125 years old today. We're going to explore the early history of our city and hear your stories. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, today we are celebrating an important birthday. It was 125 years ago to this day that Miami officially became a city. Now, before the highways and high-rises, the area was described as a, quote, promising wilderness. History Miami Museum has a new exhibition celebrating the milestone. The city is also hosting a series of events this week. And we've asked you to tell us your favorite things about Miami. And we heard from some of you via our text club. Here's Clark Frazier.
Growing up here, I wanted to live anywhere else. Now, as an adult who has spent much of my professional life working in the Miami hospitality industry, I've seen the joy on people's faces when they vacation here and realized, wait, I live here. Now I'm in love. There is nowhere in the world quite like Miami.
Yesterday, we took a look back with local historians to understand what makes Miami the place that we know today. We spoke with Dr. Enid Pinckney. She is the founding president of the historic Hampton House Community Trust. That's in Miami's Brownsville corridor. And with Dr. Paul George, a resident historian at History Miami Museum. And he started by telling us about that day, July 28th, all the way back in 1886.
Well, it's an amazing day in the area's history. Obviously, you went from a tiny village of, according to the Florida State Census in 1895, of nine people living on both banks of the Miami River at its mouth to an incorporated city on that day. The election took place in what was called a lobby building, a wood frame building built that year, 1896. There was nothing there prior to 1896 other than Julia Tuttle's home on the north bank of the river near the mouth. The incorporation meeting took place between 2 and 10 p.m. And it was all male, as far as we know, because women in Florida did not have the right to vote at that time, not until 1920. And so the voters, including more than one third of the voters being African-Americans, many of whom are Bohemian-Americans, voted by acclamation for a city of Miami. You needed 300 registered voters in order to come in as a city, which was more prestigious than a village or town classification. They also voted for a board of aldermen who made the laws, for the first mayor of Miami, for the official name Miami rather than Fort Dallas. They also voted for the logo, which would include a royal palm tree native to the area. And everybody was really happy at the end. Flagler sent a telegram down soon after the meeting congratulating the incorporators on this brand new city of Miami. So it was really a monumental day to launch the city, which remained a frontier town in many ways until the 1920s.
And, you know, you mentioned almost no women there, and yet Julia Tuttle is the mother of Miami, the only woman to found a major city in the United States. Here's Miami historian Arva Moore Parks talking about her.
When she moved here in 91, there's a great description that said this woman from Cleveland came in on a barge with her two adult children by then and all her belongings, and began to plan her vision for the city of Miami. So when she came here, it was still very much a wilderness.
Julia moved here in 1891 with her family. Real briefly, Paul, what was her vision for the city?
Julia Tuttle had a very ambitious vision for Miami. Felt like it had tremendous potential, whether it be the clouds above her, the warm waters of Biscayne Bay and the Miami River, and location. She really envisioned, we believe this in terms of a conversation with a friend, that she believed this might become a nexus between the Americas, that is, between South Florida and the Caribbean and Central America and South America. And so she was really way ahead of her time in terms of her vision. But again, she hailed from Cleveland. She first arrived here in March of 1875. You can imagine the difference in weather. So she saw great potential for the place. What she believed was it needed a connection to the outside world other than a sailboat to bring people here and there. And that connection, of course, would be the rail. It happened in 1896.
I do wonder what the weather was like back then. That's a good point. Enid, we talk about the role of African-Americans, but also he mentioned Bahamians. Bahamians emigrated to Miami in those early years. How important was that community in the formation and the history of the city?
It was very important because they brought their culture. They brought their foods. I think most of us like their pigeon peas and rice and their conch fritters and conch salad and coconut tots and all of the delicious Bahamian cuisine.
Your father migrated here in 1910.
Yes, and he used to do sponging in the Bahamas also. They also knew how to farm, even though the area had coral rock, land was barren, but the Bahamians knew how to farm, even in areas where there was coral rock. And we are still benefiting and living off some of the things that they brought today.
And you fought really hard to protect that history, to keep that history alive. But, you know, what do you think about, are enough people talking about it? Do enough people know about it?
No, because, you know, most people think that Miami as a place for immigrants started around in 1959 with the Cuban boat lift, and they don't know that, you know, back in the 1890s, that the Bahamians were coming here, and they settled in Coconut Grove, but they also settled in Lemon City. That kind of history is lost.
Paul, I want to come to you, and I want to fast forward to the 1920s. During that time, Miami was prospering, wasn't it?
Tremendously so. Its growth between 1910 and 1920 was more so than any other city in the United States. It rose from 5,500 people in 1910, according to the U.S. Census, to nearly 30,000 in 1920. And then this great real estate boom overtook the area, reaching its peak in 1925, when there was unofficially about 150,000 people in Miami, and all these new subdivisions and even cities like Coral Gables and Miami Shores arose. And so you really, you moved from the status of a frontier town prior to, say, 1920 to what I think was by 1925, 26, an emerging metropolitan area. It was just a boom. And then, of course, there was the inevitable bust or collapse, which came in 1926, and the area found itself in its own economic depression prior to the National Depression.
I'm speaking with Dr. Paul George, a resident historian at History Miami Museum, and Dr. Enid Pickney. She's the founding president of the historic Hampton House Community Trust in Miami's Brownsville Quarter. Today marks Miami's 125th birthday. The city was officially incorporated July 28, 1896, with a population of just over 300. We're talking about what makes Miami the place we know today. History Miami Museum has a new exhibition celebrating the city's anniversary. It'll be on display for the public starting Thursday. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Enid, you know, something else that's interesting, too, about Miami history is the role that it played in the civil rights movement. Extremely important. And I wanted you to touch a little bit on, you know, a couple of those moments, especially at the historic Hampton House. So much of what the civil rights movement was really did start here.
Yes, and we were ahead of the civil rights movement. The Hampton House was owned by a Jewish couple, but they permitted CORE to have its regular meetings at the Hampton House, where they planned the strategy for integrating Miami's buses, the fountains. You know, I remember drinking from the colored fountain and sitting in the back of the bus. And all of the segregation laws that we had to endure were discussed, and how we were going to protest against them right there. And Dr. Martin Luther King was there. He used to come down to the CORE meetings and meet with the CORE and all of those pioneers. Miami had his own civil rights movement before the civil rights movement.
Right, yeah. And by the way, when you mentioned CORE, just to remind people, that's the Congress of Racial Equality.
Right.
Yeah. Paul, History Miami Museum has a new exhibition celebrating the city's birthday. It's called It's a Miami Thing, Highlights from Our Collection. What can people expect to see? What kind of stuff do you have in that collection?
Such a broad array of artifacts in the collection. Everything from silver ingots, from Mel Fisher's expedition down to the Atocha, which sunk off of Key West in 1622, to a Burdine sign, the downtown Burdine store, which was the store of stores, as a lot of us know, to all sorts of memorabilia. I think it's going to be a really fantastic exhibition. It opens later this week, and you know, we really want the public to come to it. But we've been, in the words of an earlier CEO of History of Miami, the community's attic. A lot of people have contributed things to us, and we've placed them in our archives and our collections department, and we'll be able to showcase a lot of that on the occasion of Miami's 125th birthday. There's also a large painting of Juliet Tuttle that'll be on exhibition too as part of this. So I think it's a great opportunity for History of Miami, including myself, to showcase a lot of what we have. But even more important, it's a great opportunity for the public to just look at Miami's history through images and multidimensional objects and what have you, and really gain, I think, a deeper appreciation of the area's history. So we're really excited about this upcoming exhibition.
Enid, for you, what does the city's anniversary mean? What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking about how far we have come. Because, you know, I was born here, I was born in Overtown. And went to Dunbar Elementary School, went to Booker T. Washington, and I grew up under segregation. And so when I see the transformation that has taken place and where we are today, I just never thought I would live long enough to see what I'm seeing. I'm seeing, and I live in Brownsville, and who would have thought that this neighborhood would be so integrated with, I guess, there are quite a few Hispanic people are moving into this neighborhood. And, you know, I just would have never dreamed that I'd see white people walking up and down the street, walking with their dogs or going to the park and just, you know. So there's so many changes that I have lived to see. And I got a birthday coming up on October the 15th when I'll be 90 years old. So yeah, I'm just amazed at the changes that have taken place and the progress that has been made. And I just want to continue to be a part of it.
That is Dr. Enid Pinckney, founding president of the historic Hampton House Community Trust. We also heard from Dr. Paul George, resident historian at History Miami Museum. They have a new exhibition, by the way, open to the public starting tomorrow. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. We've heard from you via our text club asking about your favorite Miami things. Mark in Fort Lauderdale said, quote, "Miami's a vibrant, lively, energetic city where beautiful cultures and beautiful people mix and mingle. Days with the sun turn into nights with the stars, sustained with music and art." And here's Gabriel in Miami Beach.
It's one of the rare cities in the world that has beautiful turquoise waters on one side and a unique ecosystem on the other. yet our political, social, and business leaders tend to take this beauty for granted.
Janet in Glenvar Heights writes, quote, I'm a native Miamian. What I used to love about Miami was its small town feel with the international touch. It's now overcrowded both in people and in buildings. If it weren't for our geography, we would have nothing. So sad, end quote. And here's Giselle in Coral Gables.
The most amazing thing about Miami is the fact that we all come from a different place. My direct neighbors are from Korea, China, New York, Cuba, Spain, France. I embrace what this type of diversity does to our landscape.
And if I may say, happy birthday, Miami. 125, you don't look a day over 110. By the way, you can stay in touch with us via Text Club like they did. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, hello to 786-677-0767. And that's our program for this Wednesday, July 28th. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, a new investigation from the Orlando Sentinel examines the impact of COVID-19 on prisons. Plus, we get an update on the situation in Haiti from individuals on the island and the New York Times podcast, The Daily, coming to WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.